Okay, ready now. Okay, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for the introduction and the brief hesitation between the introduction and the lecture. Okay, we spoke about, this is our third lecture on, unity, division in American Jewish history. We spoke about the attempted unity within the Jewish community in general in the 19th century. Then we spoke about the attempted merger between the conservative and Orthodox community. And now we're going to talk about, this is strictly within the Orthodox community, the Cutler of Soloveitchik, the dream of Lakewood, the dream of YU. My goal is to analyze the influence of Ravon Cutler in American Jewry, then analyze the influence of Rav Soloveitchik in American Jewry, examine the interaction between these two Torah giants, and then try to draw some conclusions. So Ravon Cutler, he is born in 1892 in a town called, I'm not sure if I pronounced it correctly, Svislak, which was historically in Lithuania, now in Belarus. And he was orphaned at the age of 10. He was adopted by his uncle, Rav Yitzchak Pinas, a dayan in Minsk. When he was 14 years old, he enrolled in the Slobodka Yeshiva in Lithuania under the altar of Slobodka, Rav Nosson Tzvi Finkel. In other words, in the 19th century, the Harvard of Yeshivos was, the Harvard was first, Volozhin, and then when Volozhin served, there were problems with the Russian government. The next big yeshiva, there are many big yeshivas, but one of the more prominent yeshivas afterwards was Slobodka. And it was run by Rav Nosson Tzvi Finkel, Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein. He enrolled in the Slobodka yeshiva with a childhood friend. His name was Yaakov Kamenetsky. It had become Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. It's a power duo there, Rav Aaron Cutler, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky generally is more calm, and Rav Aaron Cutler was more fiery. Rav Aaron Cutler had an elder sister, Malka, who left tradition, and she became a communist and a professor. By the way, a lot of these gedolim, you think they grew into founts of gedolim, so many people went off the derech. And even like major gedolim, like they had siblings who weren't from. Like here, this is an example. Ravon Cutler had an elder sister. So she became a professor, a communist. And Rabbi Aaron Rakefetz, he gave some lectures about Ravon Cutler. So I listened to some of them. And he said in one of his shiurim that even when his sister was an elderly woman, she bemoaned the fact that her younger brother could have been a leading mathematician, but Nebuch, he ended up a simple rabbi. She tried to convince him when he was younger to leave Slobodka to enroll in the university in Moscow. And the altar of Slobodka commissioned Rav Reuven Grozovsky to censor his mail. So eventually Rav Aaron discovered that his mail was being censored and he became so upset he decided to leave the yeshiva. And as he headed towards the Kovno railway station, the altar of Slobodka was notified, and he rushed to the station. According to another version of the story, he sent a student, and Rav Aaron Cutler was persuaded to return to Slobodka. Had this not been successful, it could have been a totally different world. In 1914, yeah?
But the Slobodka yeshiva itself wasn't the best place to learn, because there were quite a few students who had heard of the compound, but they...
Yeah. Of course. Of course. Yeah. Correct. The Volozhin was, there were people who weren't, people who had other ideologies. You had that in every yeshiva, but I still would argue that the Slobodka yeshiva was probably a safer place religiously than the University of Moscow. Now, in 1914, Rav Aaron married Chana Perel Meltzer, the daughter of Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, the Rosh Yeshiva of the Slutsk Yeshiva. There's a banned book called The Making of a Gadol by Rav Nosson Kamenetsky. He's the son of Yaakov Kamenetsky. In one of the more controversial passages of the book was, quote, a reliable source reported that Rav Aaron wrote a letter to his fiancée of which her father, Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, disapproved. When it was shown to the altar, he was joined. I did not tell you he was a tzaddik. I said he had other qualities. But he will yet become so from that everyone will suffer from him. Now, most readers of this book Let me read it. Most readers of this book assume that Rav Aaron had sent his fiancée a love letter, although Rav Nosson Kamenetsky denied that the problematic note was a love letter. Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer was the Rosh Yeshiva in Slutsk, and Rav Aaron Cutler became his assistant. But after the Bolshevik Revolution, Slutsk was under communist Russia, so the yeshiva is moved to Kletsk in Belarus. You had another comment? Right. So we had a speaker years ago who spoke about this. Now, Leslie Ginsburg Klein came and spoke about the founding of Beis Yaakov. Okay, in any case, so Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer eventually moves to Eretz Yisrael. And Rav Aaron Cutler becomes the Rosh Yeshiva in Kletsk. And at its height, he had 300 students. With the outbreak of World War II, the yeshiva relocates to Vilna, which was the major refuge of most yeshivos from the occupied areas. Now, most of Rav Aaron Cutler's students did not escape, and most of them were murdered by the Nazis. Rav Aaron Cutler was brought to America on April 10, 1941, by the Vad Hatzalah Rescue Organization. Now, the Vad Hatzalah was a body originally established by the Union of Orthodox Rabbis of the United States and Canada. It's the Agudas HaRabbanim, to rescue rabbis and yeshiva students during World War II. Now, he first settles in New York, and he is committed to transplanting the Lithuanian yeshivos to America. Now, you know, Rabbi Kefet compares Rav Aaron Cutler to Rav Soloveitchik. I like the language he uses. He says the goal of Rav Cutler is to transplant, and Rav Soloveitchik is to translate. Cutler's goal is to transplant Europe to America, and Rav Soloveitchik is to translate it. We'll see a little more what that means. But I have here in this first quote, he says here, this is from Mishnas Rabbi Aaron, he says, we are obligated to translation. We are obligated to do everything in our power to plant the tents of the Torah and their character, form, size, fully and authentically here in this land. From this, we will anticipate the entire house of Israel, as it is known in the name of Chaim Volozhin, about the migration of Torah through its ten hosts until the arrival of the righteous Messiah. The last encampment will be America. Okay, we'll see if that's true. But the point is, his goal is to just take Europe, take the yeshivas of Europe, and he wants to move it to America. The truth is, though, before he starts this idea of starting yeshivas, his first goal when he comes is to work with the Vad Hatzalah to save Jews from the Holocaust. He did not attend. It's interesting. He did not attend. There's a famous Rabbi's March on Washington in October of 1943, made up of mostly Rabbanim from the Agudas HaRabbanim, including Rav Elazar Silver, Rav Moshe Feitzin, a young Rav Soloveitchik was there, and they attempted to meet President Roosevelt, but only Vice President Henry Wallace met with them. Now, Rabbi Kefet suggested that Rav Cutler did not believe in the more aggressive types of marches that were conducted. It's always an interesting question of, like, what do you do to try to influence the government? Do you take the outspoken demonstration? Do you do the behind-the-scenes work? Both. No. So his view was that Rav Aaron Cutler was used to more of the behind-the-scenes approach. And the following story is told about how Rav Aaron Cutler saved 24 rabbis who were being held in Italy and their face being returned to Nazi-occupied Europe at certain death. It's not, I have to tell you, it's not 100% sure whether it's true or it's apocryphal, but they wouldn't tell this story about me or you, but it's a great story. It might be true. It's quoted a lot of places, but I'm not 100% sure, but it's a great story. So stories like this, that Rav Aaron Cutler turns to the well-known activist and subsequent author of Ethics from Sinai, Mr. Irving Buell. He's the third person in this first picture, as we'll talk about it. Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Aaron Cutler, Irving Bunim, or Amos Bunim. So he asked him how he could intercede on behalf of these 24 rabbis. Having nowhere else to turn for help, Irving Bunim suggested the Italian mafia. So Rav Cutler urges Mr. Bunim to contact them immediately. After contacting them, he asks Rav Aaron, who are we sending to the meeting? Rav Aaron replied, you and I are going. So off they went to the godfather of the mafia, Joe Bonanno. So Rav Aaron did not speak English. So it was Mr. Bunim who explained the problem of the 24 rabbis trapped in Italy. So the mafia chief asked Mr. Putin, who is this elderly gentleman sitting next to you? So he told him, his name is Rabbi Aaron Cutler. He is the godfather of the Jewish people. So really, asked the mafia chief. Yes, replied Mr. Bunim emphatically. So tell him I want a blessing. So Mr. Irving Bunim turned to Rabbi Aaron Cutler and he said in Yiddish, he told him, I'm going to mess this up. He said, Ervil Abracha Funderav. He said he wants a blessing for the rabbi. So he said to Rabbi Aaron Cutler, that's not bad, right? So I did the phonetics there. So he said, Rav Aaron Cutler told the Rambunim, he said, Zog em er zo leben lang un starben in bet. He said, the rabbi blessed, so he turns back to the godfather, and he says, the rabbi, Irving Bunim told me, he says, the rabbi blesses you with long life and you should die in bed. Because mob bosses were often assassinated and never reached that old age. Upon hearing this, the mafia chief replied, I like that, and he promised in 2 weeks to arrange the freedom of the 24 rabbis stuck in Italy, which he did indeed accomplish. Now, 20-something years later, the story goes, in 1968, a shiny black stretch limo pulled up in front of the Lakewood Yeshiva. Two fancy dressed men get out and walk up to the office. They're looking for Rav Cutler. Out comes a man who introduced himself. So the two Italian guys say, no, not you. We're looking for an older man. So the younger man, this was Rav Schneer Cutler, who was his son. So he said, that was my father, but he passed away a number of years ago. So the Italian men explained that the Bonanno brothers and that they're the Bonanno brothers, and their father always attributed his long life to your father's saintly blessing. Now he has retired. We're taking over the business, and we've come to you for the same blessing. So Rishner turns to them, and he says, I'm sorry. My father could do that, but I'm not on that high enough level. So disappointed, the new mafia chiefs bid farewell to Rav Schneer and left. So according to the story, for saving the 24 rabbis from the Nazis, and with Rav Aaron Cutler's blessing, Joe Bonanno, the mafia godfather, lived to 97 years old, and he died in bed. That's how the story goes. Okay. So in 1943, Rav Aaron Cutler founds Beth Medrash Gavoa in Lakewood. It's a machloikes. Some say 13 students, some say 14 students. Now, what was the allure of Lakewood? So first, there wasn't the college within 100 miles of the town. And second, it was actually a resort town for many from Jews. So instead of Florida, it's like, well, they didn't go to Florida, but it was 10 degrees warmer than New York. So perhaps it was a place for fundraising. So the goal of the yeshiva was simply Torah lishma. The goal is studying Torah without an intention for smicha. So at that time, college education was seen as a necessity throughout the Orthodox Jewish world, and some Rosh Yeshiva felt that the college challenge could be solved. Like we're talking about even Rosh Yeshiva to the right of YU. Even Rosh Yeshiva to the right of YU felt that you can solve the college problem by creating an external college option for yeshiva students. To that, like, you know, you have nowadays, you have Ner Yisrael, you have John Hopkins, right? So there were, in the 1940s, so they thought that we could solve that issue also for the, like, it wasn't heard of, like, just learn straight. They realized everyone needs to go to college, even the people who didn't want to go to YU. So to that end, the American Hebrew Theological University was chartered in 1946. And was set to open in Brooklyn with the endorsement and involvement of prominent Rosh Yeshiva to deal with the college issue. Rav Shraga Feivel Mendelovitz, he was the founder of Torah Mesorah. Rav Yitzchok Huttner, he was the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivas Chaim Berlin. They were very heavily involved in this project. The college was to offer basic subjects in liberal arts and contain schools for theology, social studies administration, maybe sort of like a Landers College. To the right of YU, but an opportunity for college so that students could better succeed professionally. However, Rav Aaron Cutler, he was Eish Velehava. He was fired brimstone against this. His opposition led to an abandonment of the project, And we see that his influence extended way beyond the confines of the yeshiva. I have another quote here, the second quote here. This is what he writes in Mishnas Avraham about secular studies. It's Mishnas Avraham, volume 4, page 212. And he says, it should be said that... He writes here that it should be said very clearly before the gathering of yeshiva students, a word about the terrible mistake of splitting one day for college studies. This is a terrible and fearful thing. Apart from the deficiency caused in Torah study and the diminishing of genuine Torah scholars among Israel, how will we raise someone like the Brisker Rav who divides some of their time and talents to external studies? Now, again, he said this at some point between 1950 and 1959. He was defending the Brisker Rav here also. This is after the death of the Chazon Ish. So he was like the Gadol Hador at that time. And his Talmidim, his students, built yeshivos and kolim in many locations, including Philadelphia, Long Beach, right nearby here, Scranton, Passaic, Stamford, Far Rockaway, St. Louis, Denver, Bell Harbor, Toronto, Boston, Los Angeles, Pittsburgh, and Brooklyn. And he also looked beyond the yeshiva. He viewed children's education as the key for Jewish continuity. He was instrumental in Torah Mesorah in the United States. He was instrumental in Chinuch Atzmai in Israel to create a network and support system for yeshiva day schools. And he passed away in 1962. And there were about 100, and so he went from 13 to 14, to 160 students in his death in Lakewood, to about 1,500 students and 37 branches by its 50th anniversary. There's an article I saw in Tablet magazine dated 2016 that stated that 14,000 alumni of Beth Midrash Gavoa have established 1,050 institutions across the globe, and his yeshiva in Lakewood has expanded to include over 7,000 students. So that's obviously a brief introduction to Rav Cutler and what he started in terms of Torah Lishma, Torah only. There were some to the right of YU who were in favor of collegiate studies, but he was more to the right, and the influence was enormous. So you have Rav Soloveitchik, obviously, different philosophy. Rav Soloveitchik is born in Prusian, Poland. He was born in 1903. He's named after his great-grandfather, the Beis HaLevi, who headed the Volozhin Yeshiva, Rav Yosef Dov. His grandfather was Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, the founder of the Brisker method of Talmud study. His father was Rav Moshe. His mother, Rebbetzin Pesha, was the daughter of Rav Eliyahu Feinstein. Rav Eliyahu Feinstein was married to the sister of the wife of the father of Rav Moshe Feinstein. That means they're related. Okay. They're second cousins. The Soloveitchiks were known for rigorous intellectualism, self-discipline, and ideological extremism, single-minded devotion to Torah study, and unyielding opposition to Zionism. Chaim Brisker was very anti-Zionist. The Feinsteins were known for warmth, openness, and tolerance. Their home was host to Jews of all kinds, and their children were encouraged to study languages, literature, and science. Two different traditions, father and the mother. The father, the intellectual, moral, the mother, Judaism expressed itself not only in formal compliance with the law, but also in the living experience, the scent, the flavor, the warmth and mitzvot, so we could feel the presence of God. Therefore, the Rav Soloveitchik in his writings, there is great emphasis on both the intellectual and also the experiential aspects of Judaism. There's fusion of thought, action, and emotion in Rav Soloveitchik's philosophy. And he's raised in Koslovich in Belarusia. In Cheder, he was taught by a Chabad rabbi, more Tanya than Gemara. And eventually, when Rav Moshe, his father, finds out, he's like, enough of this. And then he assumes personal responsibility for the Rav's education. And for 12 years, the Rav dedicated himself almost exclusively to the study of Jewish law. Soon the dialectic nature of halachic logic became second nature to him, the Brisker methodology. The goal of Brisker methodology is an attempt to understand all possible conceptual approaches to a Talmudic issue. Instead of saying, I agree with this opinion, this way of explaining it, and try to defend it against attack from another explanation. The goal of the Brisker methodology is to look at, here are two different ways, three different ways, four different ways of understanding a given topic. So, and it sensitizes one to the legitimacy of different approaches. So Rabbi Soloveitchik was not afraid of contradiction. He actually believed the whole truth can be attained only through the interplay between conflicting approaches. The Rav, in other words, for example, we'll talk about this at the end. Obviously, people here probably have strong views about, you know, the yeshivish model and the more YU model. So I'm saying, for example, you could say, well, there's an idea of how we can achieve Avodas Hashem. So one way is through, let's say, a more of a Lakewood model. Another way is more through a YU-type model. And here are the advantages and disadvantages of each approach. That's how a Brisker would try to understand it. Them saying, my way is correct, and I'm going to defend it, and your way is wrong. The Rav Soloveitchik was more of the Brisker methodology. I'm not saying in the Hashkafa, but I'm saying in, from a Talmudic standpoint, when you analyze a topic, here are different ways we can understand something. Here are different advantages, different disadvantages of approach, legitimacy of different approaches. In any case, the Rav never attended yeshiva. His only Rebbe was his father. He believed that not only is a father supposed to be a teacher, but a teacher should be a father as well. He's very into the chain of Mesorah. In 1931, in 1920s, I forgot the exact date, he attended the University of Berlin. So actually, I was at a rabbinical conference the past 2 days. They told a great story when the Rav was attending Berlin. So first of all, this is after his grandfather's death. Like his grandfather would have heard about it. Rav Chaim Brisker, for grandson to go to secular college, like that's unheard of. Go to University of Berlin, like what's going on? So apparently, the story goes, this is a true story. The other one is probably, may also be a true story. This one apparently is Rav Mordechai Feuerstein, who heard it directly from the Rav, that when the Rav was in university, so there was apparently this really well-known eye doctor in Berlin. So a bunch of gedolim, sometimes they would go, when they had eye problems, they'd go to Berlin to specifically to see this eye doctor. And when they were there, they're like, what's with this Yosha Bear? Like, what's this? He's going to college? It's like he's going to university? Like, and so they go up and they meet with him. They probably think like he knows nothing about Torah, but they would talk and learning with him, and he was like toe to toe with like anything they would say to him. He was like he knew he can answer, and he was like, you know, on the same level. And after like speaking to him in Torah for a little bit, they're like, what's going on? Like how could it be you're not in Brisk? How could it be that you're like such a great such a great scholar? How could it be you know so much? So I'll tell you the difference. See, because when you learn Torah, I'm learning Torah. When you're speaking Lashon Hara about me, so then I'm going to university. So apparently, in any case, so he goes to university, and he's obviously very broad-minded. And in 1931, he marries Tanya Lewitt Soloveitchik. In 1932, he comes to America. He's appointed chief rabbi at Boston. There he oversaw, in the beginning of 1934, co-educational supplementary school named Yeshiva Torah Yisrael for elementary and high school students. In 1937, he establishes a coeducational Jewish all-day school named Maimonides, right? Still in existence, right? 1939, he opened a short-lived yeshiva named Heichal Rabbeinu Chaim Halevi for bright students who are coming to America from Europe. In 1941, his father passed away. His father is the leading Magid Shir, leading Rebbe in YU and Reitz, and he succeeds his father as the head of Reitz, but he still retains his position in Boston. He shuttles back and forth for over 40 years. Now, initially, Soloveitchik was a member of the non-Zionist Agudas Yisrael. In 1935, when Rabbi Soloveitchik submitted his candidacy to become the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, he did so as a representative of Agudas Yisrael. However, he changed his mind on this issue. In 1944, he became the chairman of the Central Committee of the Religious Zionists of America. And in 1946, he became the honorary president of the Religious Zionists of America, Mizrahi. And his shift in allegiance resulted from a frank, painful reevaluation of his philosophy in response to the Holocaust. He witnessed the destruction of, you know, obviously after witnessing the destruction of European Jewry, he comes to believe that Mizrahi's activist approach to building a Jewish future in the land of Israel had saved Judaism and the Jewish people from extinction. It wasn't the messianic approach of, let's say, Rav Kook, but it was more of a practical thing that, you know what, it's true, there we'll have to deal with secular Jews, but this is clearly something that is necessary. Now, I'll just read you two passages. I mean, he writes a lot about this, but just to highlight this, in Kol Dodi Dofek, it's an essay by Rav Soloveitchik, he wrote this in 1956, Yom HaTzmaut. For the first time in the annals of our exile, divine providence has amazed our enemies with the astounding discovery that Jewish blood is not cheap. If we want to courageously defend our continued national historical existence, the Torah has always taught that a man is permitted, indeed, as a sacred obligation to defend himself. Public and private honor is dependent upon the possibility of defending one's life and one's honor. A people that cannot defend its freedom and tranquility is neither free nor independent. The third of the phrases of divine redemption is, quote, and I shall redeem you with an outstretched hand and great judgments, right? It's from Parshas. Thank God we have lived to see the day when, with the help of God, Jews have it within their power to defend themselves. Let us not forget the poison of Hitlerite anti-Semitism, which made Jews fair game to all, still permeates this generation, which looked with equanimity upon the horrible scene of the suffocation of millions in gas chambers as a normal event that need not be challenged. As America was silent. The antidote for this venom that poisoned minds and dulled hearts is the readiness of the state of Israel to defend the lives of its citizens. Listen, my beloved Knox, as his feeling. And now in this next 1962, in his address to the religious Zionists of America, he says the following. I was not born into a Zionist household. My parents' ancestors, my father's house, my teachers and colleagues were far from the Mizrahi religious Zionists. My links with Mizrahi grew gradually. I had my doubts about the validity of the Mizrahi approach. I built an altar upon which I sacrificed sleepless nights, doubts, and reservations. Regardless, the years of the Hitlerian Holocaust, the establishment of the State of Israel, and the accomplishments of the Mizrahi in the land of Israel convinced me of the correctness of our movement's path. The altar still stands today with smoke rising from the sacrifice upon it. Jews like me are required to sacrifice on this altar their peace of mind, as well as their social relationships and friendships. You know, he's getting at the fact that he's like, all the other Gedolim are against him. And as he's saying, he sacrificed a lot because he was, you know, he was who he was, but he was the darling of the Aguda. He would have been number one in the Moetzis. I think there was I forgot who it was. There was someone who passed away, and he liked, I think it was Rav Chaim Moshe Grudzinski, but I could be wrong, that he, in the 1930s, he delivered like the Hesped. Like, he was the darling of the Aguda movement, and he sacrificed, you know, his relationships to some extent, we'll see a little bit of his relationship with Ravon Cutler, because of his stand on Zionism and maybe openness to the outside world. He dresses in modern clothes. He addresses university audiences. In 1960, he did something, now hold your breath, he began to teach in English. Just letting you know. It's a big deal. He quoted secular philosophers and theologians in his writings, and he defended religious Zionism. And so you can understand, Rav Soloveitchik translated Lithuania to America. He didn't transplant it. He translated it. He provided the Jews the ability to live in two different worlds. He was a Talmudic scholar of first rate, and he was a creative modern Jewish thinker wrestling with contemporary questions of Jewish religious belief. He was a defender of Orthodox Judaism, and he was more open to having contact with the non-Orthodox rabbis and lay leaders, as we will soon see. So what was the relationship between Ravon Cutler and Rav Soloveitchik? Now, Rav Soloveitchik had tremendous respect and love for Ravon Cutler. I want to share with you two stories that indicate this. So number one, I got this from Rabbi Rakefet about Cuban Jews. In the 1950s, during or shortly after the Cuban Revolution, Castro contacted a David Weingarten, who was a tour operator. And he told him that he would allow Jews out of Cuba, and the date, you familiar with the story?
No.
Oh, you know who Dave Harger? Okay. Dave Harger. Okay. So he said that the date that he was letting the Jews out happened to be Yom Kippur. So apparently, Kasher was unaware that it was Yom Kippur. So, but Weingarten wasn't sure what to do. If he should arrange the emigration of Jews from Cuba or not, or should he ask to have the date changed? Right? In other words, yeah, he wasn't doing it lahachis, but once you ask to change the date, is that going to be a problem? So he calls Rav Soloveitchik, and he asks if he was allowed to arrange for travel on Yom Kippur. So Rav Soloveitchik tells him, he says, I need 2 hours. Call me back in 2 hours. So he calls him, David Weingarten calls Rav Soloveitchik back 2 hours later, and the Rav tells Weingarten, do whatever you need to do, even if it means that they're traveling on Yom Kippur. A few years later, David Weingarten asked Rav Soloveitchik why he needed 2 hours to decide this question. And Rav Soloveitchik answered, well, I need to call Ravon Cutler just to make sure. I didn't want to paskin this on my own. Okay? Like, in other words, but in general, like in major, major halachic issues, even a gadol sometimes, they want to sort of get some kind of consensus. So his go-to, apparently, was Ravon Cutler. Second story, the chinuch atzmai dinner. So this picture, right, as a picture of Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Cutler, and Irving or Amos Bunim at okay, his picture of the Chinuch Atzmai Dinner. In 1956, Rav Aaron Cutler enlisted Rav Soloveitchik to serve as the guest of honor at the Chinuch Atzmai Dinner, correctly surmising that his presence and endorsement would draw a large, diverse audience of supporters. The highlight of the dinner was the keynote address by Rav Soloveitchik when he said, quote, when I look at Rav Aaron or listen to his words as they flow forth impatiently, rapidly, when I feel his presence, I feel bound by a sense of achrayus, and I'm reminded of Gedolei Yisrael. There is something within him which compels me to say, as Yosef said about Yehuda, he is mi beis Abba. In other words, something, he's from the house of my father. Something in Rav Aaron speaks as I would imagine my great-grandfather, Rav Yosha Ber Brisker, once spoke. Something like I would imagine the Chassam Sofer and Rav Akiva Eger spoke. Uplifting and filled with achrayas, a sense of responsibility. When I talk about Rav Aaron and Mi Beis Abba, I don't just mean the scholarship, his Torah, but the qualities of a gadol, the warmth and other great midos. And apparently, as it's quoted, as Rav Soloveitchik extolled the praises of Rav Aaron, Rav Aaron tugged on Rav Soloveitchik's jacket, saying, nisht emesh, nisht emesh. It's not true, it's not true. So Rav Soloveitchik, he loved him. He respected him. It's a tremendous gadol. He's okay. He thinks one way, I think a different way, but like he had tremendous respect for him. However, as mentioned, they had significant different hashkafic differences in their openness to the outside world, to college, and to Zionism. In 1956, Rabbi David Hollander, he was the president of the RCA at that point, he was likely concerned with the more modern trend of the organization, that's the Rabbinical Council of America, so he proposed that the RCA leave the Synagogue Council of America and that its members leave the New York Board of Rabbis. These organizations were composed of Orthodox, conservative, and reform rabbis. Now, he was unsuccessful. He had rabbis like Rabbi Haskell Lookstein and Rabbi Emanuel Rachman, who were there also, and they were probably more, you know, to the left. So he had a little discussion, debate. And things don't change. You have, you know, different rabbonim, and they are, say, some to the right, some to the left. Now, Rabbi David Hollander was unsuccessful in convincing the RCA and its members to do this. But a few weeks later, a different Orthodox Rabbinic Alliance, called the Igud HaRabbonim, the Rabbinical Alliance of America, a small Haredi rabbinic organization, was interested in this question. The president of this organization was someone some people are familiar with, Rabbi Ralph Pelkovitz. He was the Rav of the White Shul for Rockaway. I think Rabbi Rachman was the rabbi of the other Shul for Rockaway, right? There were two. He was the White Shul, but Rabbi Pelkovitz was the White Shul. Right, Rabbi Pelkos was the white shul, and I think Rabbi Rachman was a different shul for Rock. Right? But in any case, so he wanted to ask David Hollander. He didn't have success with the RCA, that's his major organization. So he's like, let me ask Rabbi Pelkos what he thinks, and let me ask. And he asked Rav Aaron Cutler, among others, about this issue. Oh, once Rav Aaron Cutler gets this, so now Rav Aaron Cutler this is 1956. So he's leading a group of 11 leaders of yeshivos to the following kol kore, the first statement This might be someone, Mark Shapiro said, this is like the first Kol Kore where a group of rabbis try to convince their constituency, you know, about something because of their personality. First time they try to convince their constituency of a position simply by rabbinic authority. Mark Shapiro claims it's the first time that they saw in America. That's a group of rabbis like this. So this is a translation of that's in the Jewish Observer of their public ruling. We have been asked by a number of rabbis in the country and by alumni and rabbinical graduates of the yeshivas if it is permissible to participate with and be a member of the New York Board of Rabbis and similar groups in other communities which are composed of Reform conservative, quote, rabbis, quote. I think they wrote rabbis, like in Hebrew they wrote the word rabbis. It, having gathered together to clarify this matter, has been ruled by the undersigned that it is forbidden by the law of our sacred Torah to be a member of and to participate in such an organization. We have also been asked if it's permissible to participate with and to be a member of the Synagogue Council of America, which is also composed of Reform and conservative organizations. We have ruled that it is forbidden by the law of our holy sacred of our sacred Torah to participate with them either as an individual or as an organized communal body. May the Almighty have mercy on his people and close the breaches into our life, and may we be worthy of the elevation of the glory of our sacred Torah and our people Israel. Signed this fifth day, the week of Parsky Sisa, eighth day of Adar, 5716 in the city of New York. And look at these rabbis. So Moshe Feinstein. Now, what's interesting is most of them, or maybe all of them even, are Rosh Yeshiva. This is also very interesting because in Rav Cutler, Von Cutler, ushers in the transition of who are the Gedolim. Are they the Shul rabbis or are they the Rosh Yeshiva? So this, we see the prominence of the Rosh Yeshiva. From Moshe Feinstein from MTJ, we have Rav Avram Yafin from Beis Yosef in Borough Park, Rav Avram Kalmanovitz, Mir, Rav Gedalia Shor, Torah Vadas, Rav David Lifshitz from YU, okay, Rav Chaim Mordechai Katz, Tells, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, Torah Vadas, Rav Yaakov Yitzhak Halevi Ruderman, Ne Yisrael, Rav Yitzhak Hutner, Chaim Berlin, and Rav Menachem Yosef Zaks, YU. So they ban any official contacts between Orthodox rabbis and their Reform and conservative counterparts through such organizations as the New York Board of Rabbis, Synagogue Council of America. And again, we see the shift of leadership of Orthodoxy from before the Holocaust to afterwards, from Shul Rabbanim to Rosh Yeshiva. And again, as I mentioned to you, Mark Shapiro was the first instance of Das Torah in America, where a group of rabbinic leaders try to convince their constituency to take a position simply by virtue of their rabbinic authority. Now, obviously, there's one notable name who's not there. You do have Rosh Yeshiva from YU who are signing. But you don't have Rav Soloveitchik. Rav Soloveitchik did not sign the proposed ban on interfaith dialogue or the ban against rabbis participating in the Synagogue Council of America. Now Irving Bunin, when he wrote about this incident, he said the following. I once heard from Rav Aaron Cutler in 1956 when 11 Rosh Yeshiva met and issued an isser against, there's a prohibition against the Synagogue Council of America and the New York Board of Rabbis. Rav Cutler was the chairman at that meeting, and he requested that there be no mention of the isser until he had a chance to discuss the matter with Rav Soloveitchik. However, an overly zealous individual, not one of the Rosh Yeshiva, found out about the issue and publicized it before Rav Cutler had the opportunity to meet with Rav Soloveitchik. Rav Cutler was very upset, and he told me, "This day is a tragic day in the history of in America." Instead of signing the ban, Rabbi Soloveitchik did something else. He published a very important essay expounding his views on the subject entitled Confrontation, about how we can collaborate on matters that are non-theological, like anti-Semitism or social issues, but not on issues that directly relate to theology. A lot has been written on this subject. I have for you a letter that Rav Soloveitchik wrote in a work, Covenant, Community and Covenant Commitment, Letters, and this is by Rabbi Natty Helfgott, but his letters by Rav Soloveitchik. He writes, "The principle of Jewish unity expresses itself in two ways, First, the unity of the Jews as members of the spiritual community as a congregation, which was established at the conclusion of the covenant at Sinai, in our Sinai. Secondly, unity manifests itself also in our unique political, historical lot as a nation. The enigma of our existence is primarily revealed through our loneliness and our affliction in all times, the current era included. No Jew can renounce his part of the unity, which is based upon a fate of loneliness of Jewish people as a nation. We suffer through the fact that we are, there's going to be anti-Semitism, and we are, unfortunately, we're united about that, and the mystery of anti-Semitism. And we're also united by the bris of Sinai, of the fact that we accept the Torah at Sinai. And he says, the conclusion above is very simple. When we are faced with a problem for Jews and Jewish interests toward the world without, regarding the defense of Jewish rights in the non-Jewish world, then all groups and movements must be united. In this area, there may not be any division because any friction in the Jewish camp may be disastrous for the entire people. We have to get together in fighting issues of anti-Semitism. With regard to our problem within the Jewish community, however, by spiritual religious interests such as Jewish education, synagogues, council of rabbis, whereby unity is expressed through spiritual, ideological collectivism as a Torah community, is my opinion that Orthodoxy cannot and should not unite with such groups which deny the fundamentals of our Weltanschauung. So he basically said it's what's called as klape pnim, klape chutz. Internal issues, spiritual issues we don't get involved with. Hold on a second. External issues, racism, you know, anti-Semitism, State of Israel, that we can join together. And by the way, this is, I think, consistent with his position with Zionism as well. In other words, when we're engaged in Zionism, so what are we doing? We're dealing with secular Jews in creating a state, sustaining a state, supporting a state, because we feel that this is something that we can collaborate on. And so it's not surprising that whereas that Rav Kotler also was not supportive of Zionism, and he wasn't supportive of this as well. Yeah, she? Officially. Well, again, let me be clear on an official basis. I don't think they weren't necessarily opposed of getting together on an unofficial basis. When it's an official basis, so you give recognition, that's a question of how you... In other words, I don't know if they would say you can't talk to conservative rabbis or reform rabbis, you know, privately. Well, do you see nowadays that the Agudas coming together on... I mean. By the way, now there's a little bit of a change. By the way, and that's not my topic now. But the fact that, you know, the more prominent role they're playing, let's say in Israel, like now that they, the Aguda is taking a more of an active role, perhaps in Israeli politics, maybe for the benefit. But initially, they've changed a little bit. But I'm saying, yeah, I'm saying that they initially, you know, would deal with it on their own. Yeah. Right, so it's interesting you say that because, like, I think the Haredi community has evolved in that. I think initially, I mean, again, I don't want to get into this in detail, but let's say take the State of Israel. They did. They basically formed their own community. Like, in other words, they for a long time, there were some, like the Briskers, would not even take money from the government. Obviously, some Haredim do take money, some won't. Some say, we could take money, but we're not going to, you know, we're not going to be in the government. So I would say, okay, we could be a minister. Like, so I'm saying it like they've been forced into that reality. But I'm saying that their initial position is no. And then some are moving, and how much they move, but that's sort of their starting position. And yeah, they're different positions. So by the way, the Synagogue Council of America, it doesn't exist now, right? It was disbanded in 1994. What's the impact? And let me finish and conclude with this. What's the impact of Rav Soloveitchik and Rav Kotler on Orthodox Judaism? Rav Soloveitchik guided the modern Jew with the intellectual tools to lead a dignified, authentic, uncompromising halachic Torah lifestyle in the modern world. I saw this really good, short quote passage from Rabbi Emanuel Feldman. He was a rabbi in Atlanta for many, many years. He wrote this in Tradition. He says historians will have to note a more subtle truth, that it was the unique approach and background of Rosh Yeshiva like Rav Soloveitchik that provided the intellectual framework that was uniquely suited to present classical Judaism to 20th century men and women. More than any other religious leader, he was able to demonstrate to a wide audience the intellectual rigor and discipline of halacha, as well as the profound worldview inherent in the minutia of its daily halachic regimen, a worldview which addresses itself not only to the mind, but also the troubled heart and soul of the lonely modern man. The demonstration of the universality of Torah, presented with such clarity and passion, also contributed measurably to the morale of an Orthodox community which in mid-century was being buffeted on all sides and was beset with self-doubt and dispiriting retreats on many fronts. In other words, he made the case. Soloveitchik makes the case for the value of Torah and a Torah lifestyle in a modern world with precision and clarity. We don't have to, give anything, concede anything to the outside world. We can be involved in the outside world, and we can be passionate, authentic, committed Torah observant Jews. And we say Torah. You think that Torah is some archaic, religion? No, Torah actually deals with the modern issues of the day as well. He was the spiritual and intellectual leader of Yeshiva University, the Rabbinical Council of America, and Mizrahi. Rabbi Soloveitchik represented the ideals of what some call modern orthodoxy, embracing the modern world through the prism of Torah. And even after he passed away, even now, very often when our community faces a new question, when we say, what would Rav Soloveitchik have paskin, right? What would Soloveitchik have paskin? And so these sometimes are hard to know because sometimes there's certain about of evolution. But what? Many things, you're 100% correct. He did write Lowly Man of Faith, Halachic Man. Like some of these major essays he did write. Now there's many. He was a brisker. He didn't like to write. He was very nervous. He had to be perfect to write. But some of his major essays, and he delivered papers. Like Shiurim he didn't write down for the most part. That was mostly, I agree with you, he was quoted. But certain philosophical pieces, like his key pieces, he did write down. Rav Soloveitchik provided an approach to deal with modern issues such as secular culture, non-religious Jews and Gentiles, the women's role in the state of Israel. Even though Rav Soloveitchik provided a meaningful, sophisticated, nuanced approach to deal with these issues, the question though remained whether his approach was something that could be achieved by the average Jew. In other words, is his approach too elitist and ambitious? And what I mean by that, to be like, there's always the big question. Like you go to YU, for example. So do you really have time to be fully engaged in Torah, to be fully engaged in a robust liberal arts education, right? And do well in school? Like it's some people can do it, and I'm telling you, in practice, many people are like, I want to learn. Some people can learn night seder. And I just need to get my classes to get on by. So like it's very hard. Like he was obviously someone who could fully embrace that ideal. Or Warren Lichtenstein was someone who could fully embrace this ideal. What if the rank and file modern Orthodox Jews are engaged in pop culture instead of studying high culture? What if all this engagement in practice comes at the cost of intensity, in fervor, in observance of halacha? And Rav Aaron Kotler creates a completely different approach. Kulo Torah. Disengage from the world as much as possible and only engage when need be. The world is dangerous. In reality, if we want to create communities that constantly are seeking to grow spiritually, where the members of these communities are constantly thinking, Shivisi Hashem Lenegdi Tamid, I want to feel God's intense presence with me at all times, We need to disengage with the broader world as much as possible. And that's why, for him, I want to transplant Eastern Europe, Lithuania, the Yeshivas of Lithuania, to America. He was responsible for increasing Kavod HaTorah, elevating the status of the Torah sage and the importance of Talmud Torah, the importance of creating Gedolei Torah. I have this book here from Rav Aaron Cutler, Mamarim B'Sefer Keter Torah. In this generation after the European Holocaust, when the centers of Torah were destroyed and the world remained desolate, here's the great role of the Jews of the United States and Israel to build atop the ruins and replant through that spirit to establish fortresses for Torah. You know what a fortress is? Doesn't let anything in. A fortress is for Torah and the God-fearing, and to create an atmosphere of devotion to Torah and faith in its holiness and eternity without engaging in extraneous and outside labor. Only through this atmosphere is it possible to raise a generation of complete Torah scholars steeped in Torah and spirit. He believes in an uncompromising vision of Talmud Torah, fortress of Talmud Torah. He was also successful at promoting the values of the Aguda movement. Before Rav Aaron Cutler, most Orthodox Jews were affiliated with the Mizrahi movement. It could be argued that on one level, Rabbi Soloveitchik's approach of a fully integrated Jew with the modern world was so critical in America at a time when there's a feeling that Orthodoxy cannot compete with secular society. Rabbi Soloveitchik demonstrated that we could live our best lives completely at ease with the Western world. But many have had trouble living up to that ideal. At the same time, Rav Aaron Cutler's approach on the surface seems to ignore so much of the world that God gave us. And at some level, it seems to view the rest of the world as a necessary evil that we should try to avoid at all costs. But the advantage of his approach is that it provides an intense religious grounding for those who follow that approach. Rav Soloveitchik's gray approach of trying to balance so much and use the world for Avodas Hashem has its advantages. And Rav Aaron Cutler's more black and white, much simpler approach also has its advantages, that life is simpler. And of course, both approaches are trying to adapt to the concerns of either side. Some of the YU community has moved to the right, realizing that most people cannot be so open, or people are now are too open to secular culture and values, and it's very hard to remain passionate, committed Jews while being, you know, to the center. So there's something for some, a shift to the right. Not everyone can be a Rabbi Soloveitchik or a Rambam, for that matter. And of course, for all of Rabbi Soloveitchik's wide range of secular knowledge, most of his life was spent in the Gemara and the Rishonim, studying and teaching Gemara. Some in the Lakewood community have also become more open. For example, many in the Yeshivish community do have internet access, and many go to college, and there is greater acceptance in some parts of the Yeshivish community to certain secular values. So what does the future look like? So what's interesting is, I'm sure, where it's not surprising to us, that Pew reports show that the Haredi community is growing much faster than the mono-Orthodox community. Now, is it only because of birth rates? Or is it partially because there's an attraction to it for its perceived greater authenticity and commitment by its adherents? Open question. I personally obviously identify more with the YU world that Rav Soloveitchik built. At the same time, I have tremendous respect for the Lakewood world that Rav Cutler built. Because I follow the Hashkafa Rav Soloveitchik, I like to look at models and see the advances and challenges of each approach and what we can take from approaches that aren't our own. I hope that both worlds can learn from each other, and I hope that both worlds continue to provide authentic Torah options for all types of Jews who yearn to be engaged and passionate Torah observant Jews in the modern world.